Picture this. You are standing on the Greenland ice cap. It is the middle of summer, and it is still cold enough to kill you. The wind comes off the ice sheet in long, flat sheets that cut right through every layer you are wearing. There is nothing to see in any direction except white. Behind you, there is a drill rig, a crane, a crew of sunburned and frostbitten men who have been out here for weeks. And somewhere beneath your boots, about as far down as a 25-story building is tall, there is a World War II fighter airplane. Intact, waiting. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today we are going to talk about one of the most stubborn, improbable, and genuinely moving recovery and restoration stories in the history of aviation. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you have earned it, they have got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, July 15, 1942, Operation Bolero was the Army Air Force's name for the mass ferrying of combat aircraft across the North Atlantic to England. The American war machine was spinning up fast, and Europe needed hardware. The Northern Ferry Route was the fastest way to get it there. Greenland, Iceland, the North Atlantic. It was dangerous flying, long overwater legs, weather that could turn on you in an hour, and the knowledge that if something went wrong out there, help was a long way off. But it was faster than shipping aircraft by sea, and in the summer of 42, speed was everything. On that July morning, six Lockheed P-38 Lightnings and two Boeing B-17, flying fortresses lifted off from Presque Isle, Maine, pointed east, 25 airmen, long flight, bad weather building ahead of them. The P-38 was something to look at even on the ground. Twin booms, twin Allison engines, the cockpit nacelles slung between them, like somebody had decided that symmetry was overrated and gone ahead and built the thing anyway. It looked almost unreal, like an engineering drawing that had somehow gotten out of the building and become an airplane. But in the air it was fast, it was long-legged, and it was lethal. The Germans called it the fork-tailed devil. The Japanese had their own names for it. None of them were compliments. By 1942, the P-38 was pulling interception duty, flying escort, hunting submarines, and doing long-range reconnaissance over terrain that other fighters could not reach. Lockheed had built something genuinely new, but that day over Greenland, the fork-tailed devil ran into something it could not outfly. The weather closed in hard and fast. The formation was burning fuel they could not afford to burn, circling, searching for a break in the clouds. Communication deteriorated. One of the B-17s declared an emergency. The group turned back toward the coast, looking for any kind of option, and then the fuel gauges started their slow, awful march toward empty. The decision was made, they were going down. Now here's where it gets interesting, and I mean that in the most terrifying possible way. They were landing on the Greenland ice sheet. Not a runway, not a flat field, a glacier, moving, compressing. Wind-scoured ice with no landmarks, no depth perception, no ATs, no approach plates, and no idea exactly how hard the surface was going to be when they touched down. They belly landed, all eight aircraft. Every single airman walked away. That part of the story often gets lost in the drama of what came later, but pull up a chair and let that settle for a moment. Eight aircraft put down on a glacier in the middle of nowhere, in wartime, and 25 men survived without a fatality. Remarkable airmanship. Remarkable luck. Probably a great deal of both. The B-17s in particular, those were big, heavy machines, and setting them down on ice without a runway under them and without losing anyone took skill that is hard to overstate. The crews were rescued within days. The aircraft were not. Salvage was attempted almost immediately, but the weather was brutal. The logistics were near impossible, and the military had a war to fight. The decision was made to walk away from the hardware. Eight airplanes parked on a Greenland glacier, left to winter alone. And then the ice did what ice does. The Greenland ice cap is not a frozen pond. It is a glacier, which means it flows, accumulates, and compresses continuously. Snow falls every winter, layers upon layers, compacting under its own weight into glacial ice. And anything sitting on the surface does not stay on the surface. It sinks, slowly, with absolute indifference to the fact that it used to belong to the United States Army Air Forces, it sinks. By the time anyone seriously started looking for those eight aircraft, it had been 40 years. Pat Epps, an Atlanta-based aviation dealer and pilot who had been thinking about those planes for years, teamed up with a photographer and pilot named Richard Taylor, and together they organized the Greenland Expedition Society in the early 1980s. Their early expeditions were something between an adventure and a frustration. They knew roughly where the planes had come down. They had wartime records, survivor accounts, search grid coordinates. What they did not have was a way to see through 200 feet of ice. What finally cracked the problem was ground-penetrating radar. A remote sensing team ran grid searches over the area and found returns that looked like metal beneath the ice. The planes were there. The question was how far down. The answer, when they finally measured it, was approximately 268 feet. That is deeper than most recreational scuba divers ever go, deeper than some ship anchorages. 268 feet of ice, each foot representing roughly 1 year of accumulation since those pilots walked away in 1942. Think about that for a moment. A machine that was flying combat ferry missions in the summer of 42 was now buried under the equivalent of a 23-story building. Locked in ice that had never stopped moving, never stopped compressing, never stopped doing exactly what glaciers do to everything that gets caught inside them. The device they developed to reach the planes was called the Super Gopher. And if that name sounds like something out of a Saturday morning cartoon rather than a serious engineering project, I understand completely. But it worked. It was a heated metal ring, lowered on cables, circulating hot water through a closed system to melt its way down through the ice column. Foot by foot, shaft by shaft. The team would melt down, assess, melt further, widen the shaft enough to work in, and then figure out what they were actually dealing with. Roy Schaffner, a Kentucky businessman with a deep love of aviation and the resources to back that love up, became the primary financial force behind the final recovery push. Without him, the project very likely dies somewhere in the funding gaps and failed seasons that had plagued earlier expeditions. The history of Glacier Girl includes his name for a reason. When they finally broke through to the aircraft, what they found was sobering. The planes had been crushed. Decades of glacial pressure had folded wings, deformed fuselages, and compressed cockpits. Several of the aircraft were beyond any realistic hope of recovery, but one of the P-38s, bearing the serial number 41-7630, was judged to have enough structural integrity to attempt. Getting it out was engineering under conditions that would test anybody's patience. The aircraft had to be partially disassembled down in the ice cavern the team had melted around it. Pieces were hoisted one at a time up through the shaft. The work happened in cold, in confined space, with equipment that had been improvised for a job that nobody had ever done before. The whole operation was years of effort compressed into a set of images that look absolutely impossible until you realize that every single element of it was done by hand, by people who refused to accept that the airplane was gone. The restoration itself took another decade. Bob Carden led the work back in the United States, and what that team faced was essentially the reverse engineering of a 1942 fighter aircraft from a set of manuals, a pile of crushed aluminum, and the sheer stubbornness of people who believed the machine was worth saving. The Allison engines had to be rebuilt from cores. The twin booms were carefully straightened, new systems were fabricated where the originals were too far gone. Rivets were replaced one at a time. The airplane that emerged from that restoration was as close to airworthy as 50 years in a glacier, and 10 years in a shop could produce. On October 26, 2002, Glacier Girl flew again. They had given her that name years earlier, somewhere in the middle of the recovery effort, and it stuck. There's something almost mythological about it. A wartime fighter left behind on the ice, found by people who refused to believe the story was over, brought back into the sky at the beginning of a new century. She is painted in her original wartime olive drab and neutral gray, the markings of a 1942 Army Air Forces aircraft. When she flies at air shows, and she does fly, she is not just flying. She is carrying 50 years of ice and silence and failed expeditions and Roy Schaffner's faith, and Bob Carden's 10 years of shop time, back into the light. Every pass down the flight line is a refusal to let the glacier have her. What I keep turning over in my mind is the decision those pilots made on July 15, 1942. They did not know they were creating a time capsule. They were not thinking about posterity. They were thinking about getting their airmen off that glacier alive, which they did. The airplane was a tool, and the tool had done its job, and now they needed to walk away from it. That is the entirely correct and rational decision in that situation. But here's what actually happened. Those aircraft drifted down through the ice for 50 years. One of them was found and pulled out and put back together and flown again by people who were not even alive when those pilots made their emergency approach to a glacier in the middle of a world war. That is not rational. That is something else entirely. That is what happens when the people who love aviation decide that history is worth the trouble. My sources for this segment include records from the Greenland Expedition Society, restoration documentation assembled by the recovery team, and period accounts from the Lost Squadron survivors. More history, more stories at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up.